the Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am but one of your humble hosts for today's session, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts. I'm Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm the last host today.
And the proudest.
He's feeling great.
Who am I indeed? I'm Michael Scavarla with Penn State University.
And today we are here to serve as mythbusters of a sort. We've lined up some hoaxes, some folklore, some internet lore, I guess. I don't know what else to call some of these things. We're going to be kind of mowing through these, trying to lay down some entomological truth and helping sort of sort out why some of these things maybe have popped up in popular culture. Are you guys excited?
Oh, yeah. Because this is the story of my life.
It is kind of the story of our life. It makes me feel a little bit like the Amazing Randy or the Mythbusters. So I like being a part of that kind of proud tradition. We need more people like that in our world, don't you think? Especially in these trying times.
I know. I mean, some things sound too good to be true.
And they are.
Uh-huh.
And we'll talk about why they're so attractive as we kind of go through these here today. So we've each got a couple. Before we jump into our cool content, is there anything kind of up front that we want to talk about? We've been having a lot of exciting shows. Jody lined up the last couple, and they went really well. Before that, we were at Purdue. Here in the near future, we've got more stuff lined up, maybe a little bit about red meat allergy. If you have any ideas, we would love to hear about them. We'll talk about contact at the end of the show. But what's up, Jody? You got very excited all of a sudden.
Oh, yeah, because I had a fan of the show come to my office. So she was on a whirlwind trip like throughout the US, and her subject line in an email like a couple months ago was Arthropod is awesome. And she signed off with keep on bugging. And so, yeah, she asked if I had office hours. I made time for her. She loves us. She has learned so much from us, and she is, she's a great fan. She said hi to all of you.
That's great. And
yeah, she was great. So,
well, shout out to her if she ever ends up in Kentucky or Pennsylvania.
Yeah, she will. I bet you she would reach out to you. Yeah, she's great. She's from Texas.
Ah, okay. So yeah, closer to you than the rest of us. Glad that you got to meet up with Jody and have some fun. We need swag for those kinds of things maybe in the future.
I know. I gave her a bed bug card and a sticker.
Yeah. Okay. I can get behind that. Maybe stickers of our logo, the antenna with the headphones.
Yeah, vinyl stickers are all the rage now.
Yeah, that's true. I've got them all over my water jug. So yeah, I feel you.
Yeah, I gave her a hug. I mean, we got along.
Whoa.
Famously. I know. I'm not even a touchy person. She was great. I loved her. Laura. Thank you, Laura.
You had the highest honor bestowed upon you, Laura.
I did.
Received a green hug.
Oh, I was glad you were talking to me.
Mike, anything fun going on in your neck of the woods?
Yeah, I got multiple caterpillar outbreaks all over the state.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, we're in like year three of the spongy moth outbreak, and it's getting bad again. But a couple that I've never encountered. So I had a fall cankerworm outbreak down in southeastern Pennsylvania.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever seen that. I've read that they can outbreak, but I've never seen it. It's the first one since I've been here. And yeah, like defoliated trees out in the woods. These poor folks' homes are absolutely just covered in tens of thousands, maybe millions of caterpillars all over. And they asked what they could do. And I said, well, everything you could have done was 3 or 4 weeks ago when they were little caterpillars, because now they're leaving the trees looking to pupate. Like there's maybe sweep them up and kill what you can. And that maybe will reduce the population next year. Maybe.
How do you feel about flamethrowers?
No. That's true. But they're a native pest, so like they'll all break for a year or two and then get killed off. The other one I just got today is some kind of ermine moth in the family Yponimmunidae.
Yeah.
And it's a local outbreak. It's only a few, I don't know, maybe a few tens of square yards. It seems like it's along a highway, so it might be maybe 100 yards long, but it, like, these trees are absolutely covered in white webbing, like in totally defoliated. It looks like you took a bed sheet and just covered them.
Wow.
And I looked it up. I just got this a couple hours ago. So there's only three species that it could be in the state. And I'm not sure which it is based on the host, because it looks like they're going after sumac, which is not a recorded host for any of them. But the caterpillars match up. So I told the extension agent who sent it in, like, get me some larvae. We'll rear them out to adults and see what they are, because this is kind of cool. So yeah, caterpillars all over.
Caterpillar town. It's ticks. It's just all ticks. Like, everybody's getting covered in ticks, and it's been an aggravating year for the phone calls are becoming increasingly angrier. I joked about a flamethrower before. I've had multiple people call me in the last week, and they want to know how to perform a prescribed burn on their acreage to get rid of ticks. Jody just held up a whole jar full of them, it looked like.
Yeah. I did, like, my first talk in a parking lot, and ticks were coming out of the grass to the parking lot. And nice. And the camp counselors were picking them up and actually were great at identifying, because I had just taught them how to do it. We had Lone Star ticks and American dog ticks coming out to my car where I was talking.
That's crazy. I've heard of Lone Star ticks, like, chasing you down. I haven't heard of dog ticks, American dog tick, doing that.
Well, they stayed in the grass. The Lone Star ticks came, but they were really good at identifying them. So I was like, oh, good. This is a practical thing. It was the only time I ever thought that I needed to wear a Tyvek suit. And I
Mike,
took
you
two,
seem to have a,
two showers.
I
two
do. Showers. So one of the students I've mentored unofficially in Erica Machtinger's lab did his master's research on the effects of prescribed burns on tick populations.
Right.
So maybe teaser, I'll see if we can get him on the show and actually have and talk about his research and what they found. I don't want to spoil it in case we have him on.
I know that there's some possibilities there. I myself am not super comfortable, like, handing information out to say, like, you go and burn your land.
Right. Right. but that is something people wonder about. Maybe a little spoiler. It's not as effective as you would expect.
Stuff grows back.
Stuff does grow back, and mice move. So anyway, I'll see if we can get Jesse on. Maybe that'll be a bit of a teaser for a future episode this summer.
Future episode. But let's talk about today's episode. We are doing, as I said, some hoax hunting and hoax busting. Maybe myth busting is still the better term. I'm not sure. Jody, I think that you're going to go first. And you're our pest control specialist. So you're going to talk about some pest control myths here today, right?
Yeah, I would say about, 25% of my calls this week were just, like, people sending me TikToks on, like, how to create something that's pretty and repels mosquitoes from your yard. And it was like someone cutting up some lemons and limes and putting it in a nice candle. And I'm like, yeah, nope. Like, I just answered nope to all those. And I'm like, you should make a drink with that, like the lemons and the limes. But today I
not the candle.
Correct. And yeah, it was just there. I mean, it's pretty, but it's not effective. So I think that's what you have to think about, is like, what is the goal here? Right. So when it comes to pest control or pest management, I broke it up into, like, mechanical devices. And so the first one I want to talk about is ultrasonic devices, because it seems pretty easy, right? What is an ultrasonic device? Well, it's non-chemical. It's electrically powered. So it's something that's a little box you plug into the wall. So it's very similar to a carbon monoxide detector or an air freshener. It's just there. So it's pretty. It's not expensive. You can get them relatively cheap, $10 to $100, however much. But it's supposed to create this sound that's annoying to pests. And they say insects, spiders, rodents. And so it'll just draw them away. So sounds perfect, right?
It's the anti-Pied Piper, right? Yeah. It creates a noise that they
and it doesn't disturb us, because it's at, like, frequencies higher than what we can hear.
Mike does a really good ultrasonic noise. Mike, can you make that noise for the listeners?
No, I can't.
Yeah, see?
I was like, are you making it?
That's why it's ultrasonic. That's why it works.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So I looked up, like, humans can detect sounds like 20, is it hertz to 20,000? And some of these ultrasonic devices that can be purchased are like 20,000 to 65,000. My question was, what about our dogs? Right. So they say that pets can probably hear these, but they're not bothered by it. So then you think, well, maybe these pests can hear it, but are they bothered by it? Right. So, you know, the claim, it's an audible sound and it takes care of, getting rid of cockroaches, mosquitoes, bed bugs, flies, fleas, silverfish, and then birds, rats, and mice. Sounds too good to be true, right? And there's been lots of studies over the years, and even in the 1980s, the Federal Trade Commission charged the manufacturers with false advertising.
Nice.
So there's a good hint to tell listeners, like, do not buy those and do not use those. And so there's been studies, peer-reviewed research, not effective for cockroach and flea control. They have ultrasonic devices on pet collars, not effective for that either. And these ones were in laboratory tests, not effective on cockroaches, not effective on repelling bed bugs. And they did a study, K-State did a study in 2002. It may be repellent to crickets. And that's another, you know, audible, you know, insect.
They use auditory cues. So I guess
Sense in a way. Yeah, I saw a poster on that. And then recently, like in 2021, they did some type of ultrasonic devices to try to find out if they could repel ticks, Australian paralysis tick. And it did not work. So
it's a terrifying tick name.
Right, right. So do not use these. I mean, I think people want to. Yeah. I mean, I bought a farm and there were ultrasonic devices all of my electrical sockets.
And my mom's house has one in like every room and it kills me every time I visit. They blink a big red light too in the night. Ooh. And that's when they're supposed to be going and making the chirpy noise or whatever. And it slays me. I don't want to fight, but I think maybe some conflict is necessary.
So I guess like the moral of the story is that like there are pests everywhere. And just because if you have an ultrasonic device and you have no mice or pests that you're seeing, that's not a correlation that is what's working.
Right. Mike owns a tiger repellent rock.
Yeah, I've been seeing a tiger on my property ever.
That's awesome.
It's working. And just like you pointed out, like they make these giant claims of fixing all of your pest problems, but don't hurt any of the non-pests like your cats and your dogs. Like just that claim on its face should kind of stick itself out and be like, oh yeah, this probably doesn't work. Like,
right.
And broad sweeping things are usually not true.
Right. And if it does work for a short time, whatever the organism it is, we'll get used to it and it won't be effective. So, you know, if you put it into a hamster cage, maybe the hamsters won't like it at first, but then they'll end up nesting by it. It's really nice. It's nice and warm, you know? So it's not going to be a long-term solution for your pest control problems.
Myth busted. Should we do that after each of them?
Yes.
Okay, cool. What else is in this mechanical category that you have?
Oh, me too. Okay. I did bug zappers because everybody loves a good, pzzz, right? Yeah. And they think, so what is the goal here? Are you trying to kill the most bugs, the most species, or are you trying to protect yourself against like mosquito borne diseases or mosquito vector disease? And that's usually how they sell it. So the claim is that it will like help you avoid like Zika or whatever illness that you'll have, right? West Nile virus. But the zapping sound that may make you feel very happy are not going to be mosquitoes. So a lot of the research is going to say that that's not going to be helpful in that goal. So, I mean, I think it's University of Delaware said in a 10-week period, there was 0.22% of what they caught in the bug zapper was a biting fly. So think about all the things you are killing that are not actually pests. And then other research, entire seasons, mosquitoes made up like 4 to 6% of those insects that were caught. And so there's no controlled scientific study that show that bug zappers actually work at reducing mosquito mosquito bites.
And that is their main claim, right? Like, if they're there to help with mosquitoes, it's not there to be a general pest control. Like, you get rid of flies, you'll get rid of
beetles. So, we mean, think about the things that come to the porch light. We talked about this earlier, and people are, I mean, we're always telling people to turn off the lights if you don't want these pests around your home, and then having the predators around the home, like, you know, when you get spiders and things like that. But the things that are going to come to, like, the UV light or the bug zapper, like, what are those going to be, Mike? Like, moths?
Oh, yeah. So almost entirely moths, and like maybe some flying beetles, all things that aren't pests and can't hurt you.
Right. I think they would say, like, I mean, if you think about what they're going to market it for, it's going to be like biting insects, fruit flies, like things that are pesty to people. So, and I mean, they're easy to operate. You just like set them and forget them. You leave them there. You can have really pretty ones that blend in with the ambiance. And then, you know, I don't know if people just love hearing like the zapping sound, but yeah, it's, I mean, there are way better ways to protect yourself from mosquitoes.
Do you feel like the prevalence of those has declined in the last couple of decades? I feel like I don't see as much, but that's all purely anecdotal.
I don't know. I mean, there is a place for insect light traps, though. I do want to say that. So, I mean, you know, when it comes to like food processing facilities and things and warehouses. So I'm not saying that they're not bad and those manufacturers are wrong, but I think for homeowner use to protect yourself from mosquitoes in backyards, not.
Well, can you speak to some of the differences between a light trap that you're discussing as being effective for a food storage place and then this bug zapper that
And you'll see those in restaurants sometimes. They're actually pretty, they're pretty. You can't hardly tell that it's a pest management device. But if you like walk into your fast food restaurant, like it's placed so that when doors are opening, because customers are coming in, that the flies will go to that and it doesn't zap them like explode their bodies. It stuns them and they fall onto a glue board. And so, and there are rules for that. So you can't have it by like food processing, like where there's going to be food handling, and you don't want to bring it to where there's people, right? So it's going to be like by a trash can or something like that. So, I mean, that's different than if you're sitting in your backyard, you're actually drawing the mosquitoes or whatever, the nocturnal insects towards you. So if you are bringing mosquitoes towards you, as soon as they get close to a human, I mean, they would prefer you, right? Like carbon dioxide, blood, then going and getting zapped or going toward the light. So, you know.
But I like this because there's always a nugget of something, right? I mean, there's a nugget of truth behind a lot of these. There's something that occurred or works, and then it gets kind of adapted.
We should put this in homes or in backyards. But, you know, in places where you cannot stop things from flying in, and, you know, a lot of flies will have pathogens and you don't want that in your food. So in that way, you're protecting human health. So, I mean, it depends. It depends how you use it, where the people are, where your non-targets are. A lot of times it's not going to be those pretty moths that are flying in to the insect light trap in a warehouse or something like that. So
you've got another mechanical one in your pocket, or is
I don't want to hog everything. I want to spin the dial to Mike.
Okay. Mythbuster Mike. Yes. You're on the mic.
Hello. How are you?
First time caller.
Long time listener, first time caller. So the first one I wanted to tackle was something I heard, I guess, is in high school. And it's this idea that if you lick envelopes, or it was a story that this person was licking envelopes, and somehow cockroach eggs from the envelope got into her tongue and grew and then exploded out of her tongue.
Oh.
And, you know, this story went around. I looked on Snopes because, of course, they covered this. Right. There's actually they had covered it back in 2001. And this story was circulating around the internet in the late 90s. It was one of those like early email chain type emails that we don't really see anymore. So I guess anybody younger than about 30 probably isn't familiar with it. Sorry, kids. But it was one of these stories that went around and people got scared, like, oh no, are all of our envelopes infected? And there was even a bit in the story that like, oh, it's been covered on CNN. It must be real. And you know, it felt wrong even then, but now looking at it as an entomologist, it's like there is nothing about this story that is even remotely true. So, like, break it down. There are no insect eggs in your envelope glue. Like, one, you would see them. You would just see them. Two, the idea that it's a cockroach specifically. Cockroaches lay, at least the big pest species that we have here in the U.S., American cockroaches and oriental cockroaches and brown bandits and whatever, they all lay these egg cases called ootheca, and each one contains, you know, however many
Multiple progeny,
you know, 20 to 50 to 100. And the baby cockroaches hatch out of this bigger egg case. And they're sizable. You can see them with your naked eye. They're like a quarter to half to maybe 3/4 of an inch long. Like, there's no way that that's going to be on an envelope and then somehow get into your tongue through like a paper cut from the envelope. Even if somehow it did, like, there's no way that that ootheca would then survive in your tongue to hatch out. So, like, all of it just on its face from every angle of entomology is just absolutely fake.
Right.
But it scared a lot of people. And I remember back in the late 90s, early 2000s, like, people were concerned, like, in my life, were concerned about cockroach eggs in their envelope glue. And, like, a lot of people switched over to, like, using a wet sponge for sealing envelopes. And this is also before, like, the self-sealing envelopes with the
right
pull strip that you know, has glue on it were kind of invented. So
what I'm hearing you say is this was invented by Big Sponge, the big sponge industry.
Yeah, to sell more sponges.
To sell more sponges.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So talk about why you think this was maybe evocative to people then. Like, what is it that made people buy into this, that made people pass it around and get scared? The CNN part sticks out, but what else?
Yeah, I think it's a specific place in time in history. Because this was the era of email chains and like Nigerian princes needing some money so they can claim their inheritance. Like,
right. The
internet was relatively new to most people, and the idea that your friends would just send you something that was untrue wasn't really like widely established. Like, it was,
right,
if your friend sent it to you, it must be true. And so these email chains could just take off. And, you know, the idea that, like, oh shoot, even envelopes are unsafe is evocative. Like, if you don't know any better, if you don't know any kind of insect biology, and of course, cockroaches to many people are known but scary. Like, you don't want cockroaches in your house, and oh no, now they're in my body.
Right.
So, like, there's a lot of things there. Yeah, like, there's a lot of things there that are working together on people that are, I don't want to say gullible, but there's a, like, open to misinformation that are not expecting it.
I know naive sounds a bit harsh, but I mean, it's information you're naive to. You don't know what a cockroach egg looks like necessarily. That's not just like common knowledge amongst most folks.
And it's also part of the internet before it was easy to find information. Like, Google did not exist, you know, there wasn't much online at that time. So you couldn't just go online and find the information.
The only thing I would push back against with what you said is, you said these things are gone. Like, people won't understand what an email chain hoax was like. I mean, they won't know it through email, but like just a casual stroll through Facebook or TikTok, I think right now, they have all evolved. I mean, I know because I was like searching up some spider stuff for one of mine, and it's astonishing. Just like the exact same style that you used to see with these email hoaxes, which it's like, you know, this is an important read. Please don't pass this by. Save a life. Read this thing. It's all like almost verbatim what we used to get, where it would be like, if you don't pass this on to 10 people, your firstborn will perish or whatever. It's the exact same format. And now it's just on Facebook and you tag your friends in it.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It is, instead of an email chain or like... I remember as a young child getting like physical letter chains.
Yeah.
And so maybe, I guess it is just an evolution of that it's now just on social media. I deleted my Facebook.
That's true.
Because I got tired of the racism. And so I've encountered that a little bit less in recent years, and I guess I kind of forgot that it that version of it existed.
I'm going to guess you're also not on TikTok.
I am not on TikTok either.
But you are terminally on Twitter. You've never seen anything like this on Twitter?
I mean, it exists on Twitter, but not the way it does like in a Facebook post.
Because of the word count limit and all that, you think?
Yeah, the word count limit and the way the site's formatted, I think. I mean, there is dis and misinformation on there. I also like block a lot of like when I find it's an obvious source of misinformation, it's like, yeah, I'm not listening to this. You're blocked.
Sounds like you've blocked a lot of people probably.
Later. I am liberal with the block feature.
Yeah. And I think with like the email chains, they were like from family members and like uncles and it's people that know your email address. So you're like, you know them and, you know, they're trying to help you.
Right. And so there's an automatic like level of trust there. Like, oh, my whoever wouldn't send me something that's untrue. Therefore, it must be true. Like somebody wouldn't send it to them if it was untrue. So like there's this idea of vetting that isn't really there.
Trust used to be a thing.
Yep. So yeah, cockroach eggs in your tongue.
I think that's a good segue for mine. The first one that I picked for today, it's just basically about earwigs. We've talked about earwigs on the show before. I talked about my experience being pinched by one with their circe at the tip of their abdomen. There are a lot of people who I think find earwigs kind of creepy. Their name is also very evocative of maybe being something that would get into your ear or into your wig. And linguistically, that kind of has an interesting background. As I kind of researched this, I found out, according to people who've done this digging before, and we'll post a lot of our references in the show notes, the things from Snopes and places like that. Apparently, there's the myth that earwigs want to get into your ear. And the myth that earwigs can get into your ear and then bore through your eardrum to get to your brain has been around for a long time. I thought it was sort of a sci-fi type thing, but apparently there are Anglo-Saxon references to this as early as the year 1000. And there's this idea that the name earwig comes from eorwicha, which is an Anglo-Saxon Old English word for ear beetle or ear creature. And then apparently other, almost all cultures that knew of earwigs in the past, their common name for it, like German, it's earworms, French, it's ear piercers. They all seem to evoke some sort of primal fear of these things getting into your ear. Have you guys ever wondered if they would find you at night and try to eat your brain?
Well, no, I have not.
Not since I became an entomologist, but in one of our past episodes, I think I talk about my childhood earwig issues.
Yes.
I'm cured.
You're cured. Science cured you.
Yes.
I think that's interesting. I want to know like what the year 1000 email chain version of this was that made everybody kind of buy into it and name this thing.
The fact that it's so apparently widespread in European cultures makes me wonder if there is some like, yes, their first record is in 1000, but like, I wonder if this is some older idea that like, you know, whatever the pan-European language was or whatever, the Indo-European root language or whatever. I wonder if it goes back even that far.
There was some people that talked about, there's apparently, I think this was on Popular Science. There's a verse from Pliny the Elder that's all about, it's either how to get an earwig out, or it may just say how to get an insect out of your ear. His idea is that you get your best friend to spit in your ear and then it will crawl out. And some people say that the actual wordage in the part that he wrote is earwig. Others say it's supposed to be just insects in general, like bugs get in your ear. So you could maybe blame Pliny the Elder. He's not just a beer. He's also a philosopher.
That would make sense. It would make sense in that a lot of people then picked up on that and later, like a lot of Europeans picked up on that later, I guess.
Right. As they get more obsessed with Greek philosophy and Greek culture.
Yeah.
I mean, have you guys had someone come in with a bug from their ear?
I have had friends have bugs in their ears. Yeah. I know of bugs in ears.
Yeah. I mean, it sometimes occasionally rarely happens and it sucks, but they are not living in your ear generally as a place of harborage.
Right. They don't want to live there.
As a favorable condition.
Right.
I last week had a spongy moth fall into my ear.
See?
Wait.
Yep.
What were you?
The caterpillar?
Caterpillar. I mean, like I said at the top of the show, there's a big infestation here. And I was walking under my walnut tree and I didn't even think I felt it, but like I went to scratch my ear and something in there popped. Like, oh no, what is this? And I pulled it. I was like, oh no, it's a spongy moth. And they've got like not got quite hairs. Irritating hairs, but yeah. It didn't irritate anything, but man, that's a bit of a sensitive part of the body to be squishing caterpillar hairs.
For sure.
It does. Obviously, like it does happen occasionally. It's a place insects can get on anywhere on your body, right? Like it could have easily fallen in my hair or on my face or on my arm.
My mouth.
Yeah. It's but they don't want to live there.
Yes. Right. So it's gross in there. It's full of earwax and stuff. But yeah, they'll wander in, they'll take a gander, check out the real estate. There's lots of reports of this. You can find images of jumping spiders, little tiny species of them hanging out in the ear. The designer of our logo for the show, my friend Justin Stewart, he's a local comic book artist, Justin 3000. He had a beetle in his ear about 3 years ago, and he was texting me up a storm asking about why this happened. And he made a little mini comic that he started of like the beetle trying to turn him into a beetle from his ear hole. So I think it's like an evocative thing. There's a reason that this would persist. It's a part of pop culture now. Like if you remember Animorphs, I think that the alien creatures in those books, they crawled in people's ears and looked kind of like earwigs. Rod Serling had a Twilight Zone episode that was kind of based around this myth, or was it Twilight Zone or the Night Gallery? I don't remember which Rod Serling show it was, but there was like caterpillars that could get into your ears and acted like what people say earwigs do. Everybody sort of says, you know, it's not that common. It's not really, it's not their thing. It's not what they're looking to do in life. I did find two medical journal reports about earwigs specifically happening. The first is from the 1980s. Is that right? Yes, 1986, August of 1986. A person wrote into a medical correspondence journal and talked about how he took his 8-year-old daughter to the hospital because she had heard the sounds of, quote, little feet in her ear. And an otoscopic examination revealed a dark brown mass near the tympanic membrane. And it turned out it was an earwig. This doctor goes on to say, you know, they're harmless. This will probably never happen again. It's not something that you can find a lot of evidence about, but he specifically is the one that apparently talked about reading into this Anglo-Saxon myth and stuff because he was so intrigued by this. And lots of people go back and reference this original publication and further ones that talk about earwigs. But he says, you know, if this has ever happened before, I can see why people believe this about earwigs. And then the most recent one I found was from Korea in 2021. And sure enough, there was a 22-year-old man who said that his ear felt weird and there was something in there. And they did an examination and they saw the cerci sticking up and it was just kind of hanging out in there and it was stuck and they got it out. And they talk extensively about how people think they want to get through the eardrum and get to the brain. So it doesn't happen. It's not real. It could happen that you might end up with an earwig, but don't lose sleep over it. Your ear's not that attractive.
I guess the last two things I'd have to add to your story, if I may. There was something tickling at the back of my brain, not an earwig, but an idea that like people have wondered if earwax has like anti-insect properties because bugs could get in there. And I looked on Google Scholar real quick just now. There's nothing real concrete about it, but there have been suggestions of like earwax having antifungal or antimicrobial properties.
Okay.
That may or may not really exist. So I wonder if there is some kind of like insect irritant property to earwax that is like, if they do happen to get in there, they don't like it.
It's gross in here, Dad.
Yeah, well, and like if an insect gets stuck in your ear, it's gonna like if it doesn't like it in there, it's gonna try to scratch and get free, and that can be upsetting. The other thing is there are some insects there are some arthropods that do preferentially get into ears. And I'm specifically thinking of Spino's ear ticks. So have you encountered these in Kentucky?
I have not dealt with that necessarily. No, go on.
So there are ticks, they're soft tick species, and they primarily get on cattle and other ungulates. And we get them in the southeast, in the southwest of the U.S. And I know about them because when I was a student in Arkansas, a vet contacted me and said, "Hey, I got this tick out of a cat's ear. What is it?" And I identified it as the Spino's ear tick. They preferentially get in cattle ears, but they'll also get in other things like cats. It happened. It was a barnyard cat.
Right.
So it was kind of cool. Like this first record of a first clinical record of a Spino's ear tick in a cat. But the more I dug in the literature, they've occasionally been reported from people. They find us, we're not cattle, but like they'll get into mistaken hosts like cats and people and dogs. And because they get into cattle ears, they will get into human ears as well.
Right.
There's not very many reports of it happening, but like, and it's not an earwig, obviously. But there's lots of arthropods out there, and lots of arthropods do lots of things, and just happens that there is one out there. This Spino's ear tick that is preferentially gets in mammalian ears. So there again, kind of a kernel of truth, different organism,
right?
Not known to Europeans, but like there is a thing out there that kind of sort of does this.
My dog had ear mites once. So yeah, I mean, ears are a place of habitation. There's space in there. There's potential resources, especially if you're parasitic. So like it makes total sense to
me. If you're going to feed on blood, then like you don't want to be bothered, so like ear is the place to go, but like an earwig, that's not a really great place to hide,
not really conducive to your lifestyle if you're an earwig.
Right. So
but yes, there are things out there that hunger for ears and ear spaces, I guess, but they don't necessarily interact with humans very often, and the chances of you getting an insect in your ear are quite low. Especially when you listen to arthropod with your headphones on. So just, you know, keep listening to us and you'll stay safe. I think that spins the dial back around to Jody. Jody's got some more pest control things. I think she's going to lob some, is it hedge apples at us, or what are you going to hit us with here?
Oh yeah. So I did a couple of those mechanical ones, but this one could go on forever. So this, I guess, subtopic is, okay, I got to use the right language. Stuff you put around your house to repel insects. The list goes on and on and on. I am going to focus on hedge apples, but I don't know if it's everywhere. I don't know if it's a Midwest thing, but there are so many different things, from, you know, sprinkling cinnamon around the house to get rid of ants, using dryer sheets, tuck it in your pants to get rid so mosquitoes don't bite you. How about baking soda? It'll cause things to explode. Why don't we put wet tea bags in the corner of our rooms? Copper pennies in some water, you know, planting different plants. So like all of those things. So there are, the list goes on and on forever. So I'm going to focus on the hedge apples. And so if anybody doesn't know what a hedge apple is, it's not an apple, and I love apples, and it's from the Osage orange tree, and it's not an orange. What it does look like is like a giant softball that's like a green, yellow, warty thing, and it kind of looks like a giant brain, and each one of them is like 2 pounds. Like, that's like a heavy, weird thing. They fall out of these Osage orange trees that are found pretty much, they say, so from zone like 4 to 9. So they could be in a lot of different places. I know my in-laws have them in Indiana. I'm sure you guys have seen them. We have them in Omaha. In October is when those fruits, I guess, get produced and they fall on the ground. So they're all over the place. They're actually really annoying. You can like, if you can break a leg or ankle running on the trails, but people will gather them up and take them home because they think when you put that around your home, it will repel spiders is the main one. Let's see. So the natural range, Oklahoma, Texas, Arkansas, but they can grow in a lot of different places. The fun fact about these hedge apples, these trees, they were used along property lines before there was barbed wire, because they're really thorny and they're really good at, like, I guess, for windbreaks and all this other stuff. So that was like the initial hedge. Yeah. So they are pretty widespread. The wood is not good for a lot of things, and it actually doesn't get attacked by a lot of pests either. So
I'm sensing the nuggets of truth, or the nuggets of possibility here.
Yeah. So it's good. They're good for windbreaks, good to stabilize soil, a lot of erosion control. It's a very textured, like, good hedge type plant, but it's been found in like the 48 the US states, and it's wind pollinated. And let's see. They talk about what it can be used for. So the heartwood is good for making bows for the Native American Indians.
I'm just reading that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it did have some uses, and for a yellow dye you know, for color. And it's pretty much that heartwood. So the wood that's in the center of the trunk that's dead, it's pretty resistant to decay. And I think to termites also, but so I don't know, so it's
got
some
utility.
Yeah, I mean, the wood is got some, yeah, but these hedge apples, you can find them at farmers markets. People will start selling them, people will give them to you. But okay, so these hedge apples, if you like squish them or they get all bruised, it oozes this like really stinky white sap. And it's like this, they call it like this milky juice, and it can cause a skin rash. Like, it sounds terrible. And then it blackens the fruit. So like, if it gets like ruined or bruised, like, it's just going to turn into a nasty mess. So Osage orange, that's what the tree is, that is thought to have like this repelling effect. And there has been some studies, especially out of Iowa State, that has shown that the extracts, like if you take like the purified, Osage orange, it may have some repellent effects. And maybe even if you slice up these nasty things and put them outside or whatever, they have some repelling effect on some of the crawling insects. However, putting whole hedge apples around your foundation or in your home is not going to work at keeping away spiders or rodents or anything like that. But if you go online, there's a lot of different websites on how to use them, how pretty they are, when to replace them. You can buy them for 50 cents each. You may even have friends just give them to you because they're like all over the place. The more you have, the better the results. It's like, you know, non-chemical, and like they're just beautiful. But
that really gets at the heart of it, right? A lot of people don't want to spray something, quote unquote, right? Like, they don't like the idea of chemicals. So the idea of like just taking what would otherwise be sort of a waste product in nature and utilizing it for pest control, that's a very attractive idea. It is sad that it doesn't work, but I mean, unless you're cutting them up and then putting it in Tupperware and putting the bugs in the Tupperware, it sounds like you're not going to get the efficacy that you seek.
Yeah. And the studies had them in an enclosed space too. Right. So it's going to be completely different when you're like putting them in a crawl space or something like that. And knowing about how gooey and icky that sap is and how it turns black, and like, they make sure to put it in a container and make sure to replace it often. So, you know, you think about the cost benefit, like, yeah, it's free and it's like out in nature and they're just like rotting outside. Well, I don't know, like, bring them in and have them rot inside. That's not cool either. So I would say, the whole hedge apples, like, leave them outside.
Or use them to squish the cockroach when you see it. I mean, it is pretty heavy, like you said.
I mean, they are cool looking things, but yeah. Do you guys know about hedge apples? Like, was that a thing when you were growing up? Okay. Cause I had never seen them until I moved to the States.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. Cause I don't think,
I bet you can't grow them up in Canada.
Yeah, maybe not.
If their native range is Oklahoma and Texas and Arkansas, yeah, it's probably a good indicator.
But I want to hear what you have to say.
Oh no, just to John's comment, like, yes, that is their native range, but they're really hardy. Like, you can grow them here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, they're all over.
Range was restriction wasn't because of temperature. And like Jody said, they were moved about by white settlers because they made great hedges and fence posts. So they're all over the country now. Native Americans may also have moved them. But now that I'm saying that, I'm not sure, and I'd have to double check, but they have been moved by people, because they're useful for certain things. I guess the other thing I'd say is Osage orange is my favorite wood out there. It's the densest wood that's native to North America, and it sands really nice and smooth and shiny. It's a bear to work with because it's so dang hard. It's like working with a piece of metal. But the products that you can make with it are really pretty. I really like it.
What have you made with it?
Just small carvings and stuff. I've got, I've had a piece of drying Osage orange in my shop for like 20 years at this point, because I got it as an undergrad, and that feels weird to say, 18 or 16 years or something. I've been meaning to do something with it. It's just never had the time.
Can you carve it? Can you make it into like a shoe or something and like slap bugs with it? And then like maybe sure that would be could. More useful as a pest management device?
A fly swatter.
So I've seen people use the fruits as decoration. Like they'll have like, I don't know, a bowl on a coffee table and just fill it with Osage oranges because they look pretty.
Yeah,
they're cool. And now I wonder, looking back, like, was it because they were pretty or because they thought they were pest repellents?
Maybe a little of both.
A little of both.
Yeah. Do you guys hear about those other things? Like where you are locally in each of your respective states, what do you hear the most that people put around their homes to get rid of pests?
If it's not Osage oranges or hedge apples, it's dryer sheets. I've met a lot of people that they swear by putting dryer sheets in their pockets or putting them in their mailbox or like tucking them around the base of their home outside. And they say that repels a lot of things.
I can say that there is no science to back that.
Sure.
there is like, I guess, how do you say that? Linoleum in it, which is in some of the different like oils, essential oils, but
from wool, right?
Linoleum.
Oh, maybe we're talking about different things.
Oh, yeah.
This is great audio.
Delete this part.
Pronouncing things. No, I'm not going.
Oh, okay. I was like linoleum. It's found in like lavender and basil and coriander, and it's said to repel like mites and beetles and cockroaches and Mexican bean weevils. Like it seems like the most random types of insects, but it has not had any science to back that. But
it sounds like it's the same as the ultrasonic stuff. Like it does everything. It repels everything you want it to repel. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, like you should be suspicious right off the bat.
Right. And so like a lot of the things that's kind of based on like when you extract and purify oils from like orange peels or whatever, that has shown to be some kind of effect, like slightly. But then you have to think of the big picture and how people are actually using it in their homes. And that will have no effect because of like volatility or time or space, you know? So like putting wet tea bags all over because it's peppermint, like that's not helpful. So, I mean, it sounds too good to be true, and it probably is, even though I wouldn't want to put my wet tea bags like all over the house. But carry on. Someone else go next.
Spin the wheel. Comes up Michael Scavarla.
Hey, it's me again.
Yeah.
So the second one I have, and this is another one that I heard, I guess, as a child, and I'm sure you two have heard it as well, is that it's illegal to kill praying mantises. Have you either of you heard that you'll get a fine either from the federal government or the state government or some law enforcement body? It's never clear who if you kill a praying mantis, you're going to get a fine or go to jail or something.
Secretary of Ag will show up at your door.
Will they have a badge?
Is it presumably
state entomologist coming and arrest you?
My name's Dirk Johnson, mantis cop.
Have you guys heard that, though, that it's illegal to kill praying mantises?
I didn't hear it as a child, but I did hear it later in life.
I didn't hear that.
Okay, maybe it's an American thing. I did hear it as a child a lot. And again, it's one of these, like once you get into entomology and kind of know what's what, it doesn't make any sense on its face. Like the mantises that most people are talking about are introduced species, either Chinese mantises or narrow-wing mantises or European mantises that aren't supposed to be here anyhow. And so like, if you kill them, nobody cares. They're depending on your view, potentially invasive species that are outcompeting native mantises.
They're non-natives.
They're non-natives. Okay. There are native, like here, Carolina mantises, but mm-hmm. like people can't differentiate them from the non-native species. But also like all four species, at least here in Pennsylvania, are really common and abundant. You can find all of them all over the place. So like, why would killing one matter?
Good question.
It doesn't. And I, in looking around again, Snopes was useful for this. This idea that it's illegal to kill them goes all the way back at least into the 1950s. So it's not like, it's not a new phenomena, although it does keep getting perpetuated. I wonder how much of it has to do with the fact that they're often seen as beneficials. Like you can buy mantis egg cases from garden supply stores or whatever to like let the mantises hatch in your garden, or they're good to have around. And so you shouldn't kill them. Well, if you shouldn't kill them, it must be illegal to kill them. But again, it's not, nobody from the government cares. They're not going to kick your doors down if you kill a mantis.
It'd be hard for them to know.
It would be hard for them to know. Like, yeah. What, your neighbor's going to turn you in? It's like 1984?
It makes me wonder, you talked about their biological control aspects. It makes me wonder if they're like the nugget at the center of this, if you dug deep enough, like there was a USDA experiment of augmented releases of European mantis or Chinese mantis in the 1950s. And they said, they told some kid, like, don't kill these. Or we'll give you a fine. This is our experiment. And then that like takes on this ungodly metamorphosis to become what it is today.
Yeah. Well, and it's actually, it so many people have heard it, at least in my experience, that it is actively not useful. Because now I get questions like, well, with these non-native species, specifically with Tenedera species, the Chinese and narrow-wing mantises, like I see, like they're killing all these native insects. Should I kill egg cases when I find them? Should I kill adults when I find them? I thought that was illegal. Like people are confused now because there's these two pieces of information that are at odds with each other, that you can't kill them, but also they're, you know, killing native things. And now there's this big push for native species and eliminating non-native species, and they're not sure what to do. And I get questions every year, and we had a whole episode about mantises a little while back, if you all want to go back and listen to it, if you haven't heard it. But you know, people aren't sure what to do with these conflicting bits of information that they've heard through their lives.
Do you know if there are insects that if you do kill them that you will get charged?
Endangered species for sure. Things like American burying beetle, like they're endangered on the endangered species list. Presumably there is a hefty fine if you were to kill one and somehow be caught doing it. Maybe right. If you took a TikTok video of yourself doing it and had evidence. So yeah, things like that are federally endangered or endangered on the state level, perhaps. But again, even like John said, with mantises, like unless there's a video or something, no, like how are you going to prove it?
Right.
And even if you did like take a video of you killing an American burying beetle, man, it's like, who in the federal government is going to come down on you for that? Like they should, but because mm-hmm. they're endangered, but like I just find it hard to believe that that would be enforced on an individual level. If you're like a company that is knowingly bulldozing habitat, like that's a problem.
Right.
But I can't imagine the feds would like come knock on your door and be like, well, you killed this one beetle and we know about it.
Except but for maybe Dirk Johnson, won't. Mantis cop, he'd be there.
Dirk Johnson might follow up.
So that is a myth.
So myth busted. You can kill mantises. Nobody cares.
You can kill them. Does that mean it's my turn?
It's your turn.
I'll close this out with another internet hoax from the same era of Mike's internet hoax. It's called Arachnius gluteus, also known as the South American blush spider. This is a internet urban legend that goes all the way back to 1999, to those bygone days, when kind of internet culture was still being formed, as Mike mentioned before. And pranksters at the time had already sort of figured out that you could send these email things. They based it off the letter chains and everything. But there were lots of people who seemed to have kind of a keen interest in doing this. The person that started this, actually, he came forward and talked to Richard Vedder, Rick Vedder, former guest on the show, about this whole thing when it happened in 1999. They actually began an email correspondence and I think are still in contact today, according to one of the articles I read, at least. And he said that he wanted to make this thing that was so ridiculous on its face that people would start thinking about things that were forwarded to them through email. He had somewhat noble intentions, it seems like. So he made this like completely bonkers story about a butt spider, if you haven't translated Arachnius gluteus already. And he thought, you know, people will read this and they'll think and they'll catch all these red flags. And then they'll take the next step and figure out that it's fake. And then maybe that'll stick with them going forward. The story that he produced, you can find it on various websites. Just a short synopsis is that there's an article that is being written by Dr. Beverly Clark in the Journal of United Medical Associations. It talks about there are three dead women who had no connections besides the fact they had all visited Big Chappie's, a restaurant in Blair Airport in Chicago. Already the red flag should be focused or should be popping up. There was no way to know what happened to them until a waitress came back from vacation to Big Chappie's. And while she was there, she was collecting her check. She didn't eat any of the food or drink any of the water, which they had suspected had killed these other three women, but she used the restroom. And so the Department of Health went out and they found under the lid of the toilet a spider, the South American blush spider, Arachnius gluteus. It finds toilet seats hospitable, matches up with their natural territory in the wild. And it was captured and identified. And then it turns out that multiple planes flying in and out of this airport coming back from South America are infested. A lawyer is bitten and saved because they have this information. And it ends with sort of besieging you, praying that you will check every public toilet that you sit on. You check it for spiders and that you should pass this on and save a life. That's kind of how it ends. It's very compelling stuff. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I mean,
do you remember this one at all, like back in the day?
No, not at all.
Oh, really? Oh, see, I remember this one. I remember hearing about it, and I remember Dr. York when we were at Purdue. He had a lot to say about this one. He had his spiders class for undergraduates, and I remember this coming up in there as well, talking about how this is. It's very classic, right? Like it plays on a lot of our fears. One, it involves your private parts, so that's kind of scary. There's some association, like in America, at least in places where people had outhouses, there's like long held folklore about being careful of spiders in the outhouse. So we already kind of had this connotation of spiders wanting to get in and around your butt. And then you have to think about just general arachnophobia and the fact that people don't like spiders. Also, it gets modified after 1999. There is a whole American entomologist article that I'll link to. That talks about Richard Vedder's experiences with this and UC Riverside creating a website in response to this. And they actually had all this data about how you could track their hits on their webpage going up as this sort of takes off and then trailing off to show how they're helping to kind of defeat this myth, basically this hoax that's going around. It got mutated in 2002 and somebody else took this and made it an email thing again. But they removed all of these fictional things. Big Chappie's isn't a real restaurant. Blair Airport isn't a real airport. It's O'Hare in Chicago. The Journal of United Medical Association doesn't exist. Dr. Beverly Clark presumably doesn't exist in the capacity that it's presented in this article, at least. All of it is fake. Like the spider's fake. There's nothing real about it. The person that brought it back from the dead, they put in a bunch of real stuff. So they replaced the Journal of the United Medical Association with the University of North Florida. They put in a real airport, a real restaurant, and they chose a real spider species as well. Telamonia dia, can't read my own handwriting, Diomedeida, the two-striped jumper, which is a Southeastern Asian species rather than a South American species. And then this went and made the rounds again, and it had sort of that better air of authenticity because of all of these real things that were put in there. Steve Hurd, the admitted inventor of the story, he finds this aggravating that they did this. He thinks it's much more mean-spirited than what he did. I don't know. What do you guys think about that when people make these pranks online? Like, is it mean on its face, or is there some noble purpose that could be polished out of this?
I can see where the original author was coming from because they put in so many things that are easily debunked.
Right.
I don't agree with what they did, but I can see where they were coming from. The follow-up one, I think, is just totally wrong. I got burned by a fake, like, April Fool's news story about dinosaurs one time that was presented as real and had enough real stuff in it that was like, oh, this is real. Like, I'm excited about this discovery. And then, like, 4 or 5 years later, realized that it was fake when I tried to find follow-up information. Like, oh, this is published by now. Yeah, I'm still bitter about it.
Yeah, I can tell.
And so I, like, all of that kind of stuff I hate. Because it tricks people right into thinking something's real when it's not. And, like, especially when you start weaving in real information, just to, like, fool somebody, like,
you've maligned this poor species of spider that's never done anything to anybody.
Well, and then,
that's a terrible April Fool's prank that you suffered. Much less, mine is more superior when I kidnapped your mattress. That harmed nobody but you.
That was funny. But also, like, especially in today's day and age when people are, I guess, questioning science more, like, we don't need to give them more reasons to do that.
I think that's important to point out because this didn't die as email became sort of like an official mode of communication. It had reoccurrences according to Snopes and Wikipedia in 2012, where it popped up on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr, of all places. Then it had a rash in 2018 on WhatsApp, and then reappeared on Facebook in 2019. So I tried to find it. It seems like it's been scrubbed fairly well from Facebook. But the reason I like this so much is that it reminds me of an experience Jody and I went through. Do you remember in 2018, the spider from hell that had the University of Nebraska picture of the woodlouse hunter? And we got roped into that.
Yeah. I mean, we got emails directly to us like, Jody, why are you lying to us? Like, right. If you tell us this, if the University of Nebraska Lincoln is telling us this, it must be true.
Right. And we weren't. The University of Nebraska Lincoln wasn't saying that. This is the other trick that I think a lot of these employ, is they'll pick a random institution, CNN, the University of Nebraska Lincoln, the University of North Florida, whatever. And it gives it just that, like, sweet taste of authenticity to have something real in there. And so they took our real photo, made up this whole thing about the woodlouse hunter killing 5 people and that it was a demon spider. And it got shared hundreds and hundreds of thousands of times. And made a lot of people very nervous and upset. It's all wrapped up with our arachnophobia and things like I mentioned before, but it also evokes the fact that Facebook is very powerful. The internet is very powerful in terms of being able to power misinformation. So these aren't all harmless. I think that's what Mike was kind of getting at, is there's a lot of potential for harm here. So if you're thinking about doing it, maybe pause for a second and really consider what could happen. Steve Hurd, I mean, this isn't what he meant to have happen, to have people talking over 20 years later about this being this huge problem. But that's what happens. And it still happens. I've got one I pulled from Facebook that's about brown recluses. Jody, you seem to have something to say, though, before I try to find this.
Well, you know, I'm not a fan of lies. But I also think, it just makes me sad that he thought, like, oh, we're like humans, we'll be able to figure this out. And obviously it totally backfired and it gives us like no hope that we have any brains and like humans. Cause we just like perpetuate the lie. We keep going with it. We spread it along to people without even stopping and thinking like, is this real? And then when we do stop it, someone else brings it back. And so it makes it harder to decipher like what's true and what's not. And yeah, it's, I don't agree with it at all.
Yeah, I think that's a really good note, just to say, like, think about what you're doing. Like, think about the impact it has on everything. Like, it really, right. It's not a good look for people. And it will echo down through the ages, sadly. Like,
yeah,
whoever came up with earwigs in the year 1000 probably didn't expect this either. But
and that keeps going. But like, even when it's squashed, like if we were like, no, that's not true, that's not going to be spread as widely and as quickly. Like, oh yeah, that wasn't true. Right. Right. So those myths just keep going.
Yep. I think that Mike, you talked about our Mantis episode. I alluded to when Rick Vetter was on the show. He's fought this fight against brown recluses for years, or about brown recluse misinformation for years. That's what I ended up finding when I was trying to find the butt spider stuff on Facebook, was the same kind of style of post about a dangerous spider, but presented in the same sort of email format. And it's always about brown recluses. There was nothing on there about these other spiders, but they all said something along the lines of like, at this time of year, this is worth seeing. Protect your spouse, your kids, your grandkids, and friends. It talks about where brown recluses like to hide, and then that they're all over the United States. And it has these images of people's arms being harmed. And then this other person, they tacked in this whole thing about their doctor died on the operating table after being bitten by a brown recluse, and he was only 40 years old or something. So misinformation, it's real, it's out there. We get aggravated by it, but it's just because it seems like this is a never-ending Sisyphean task, and it's not appreciated when people make more new ones about insects. So please reconsider before you make your bug prank for TikTok or whatever.
Yeah, and if you need any, I would say, advice or suggestions on how to keep, you know, pests out of your home or to deal with that, then I mean, it's not going to be as easy or as cheap or as like appealing, I guess, to some people, but it's going to be like, you know, keeping it real with IPM.
Nice. With that, we hope you appreciated our dive into some folklore, some myth, some misconceptions. We'll be coming back to you in a couple of weeks with another entomological episode. In the interim, if you want to find us, we're on the internet, arthro-pod.blogspot.com, full of nothing but truth. We're also on Twitter at @arthro_podshow. I'm at Bugman John on that platform.
I'm at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
I can't believe Twitter still exists.
It's true. We've teased that for a while.
Yeah, we thought it'd be dead. I'm on the bad website at mscavarla36.
Until then. Hit us up. Let us know what you want to hear about. Find the show. Leave a rating and a review. That always helps us. And we hope you will tune in for the next exciting episode. Catch you then.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time. Same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod Gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging. Everybody, do your breathing exercises. How now, brown cow.
La 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 la.
AEIOU and sometimes why.
Betty Bob Butter, but the butter was bitter. Somebody bought better butter to make the bitter butter better.
Peter Piper, make a bucket, 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 make a